joyful play,
purposeful work,
rugged outdoor living.
Our camps and conservation efforts
teach timeless skills
and kindle the spirit within.
Farm and wilderness.
Farm and wilderness.
Farm and wilderness.
Hey everyone, welcome back to the Farm and Wilderness podcast. My name is W and I'm the host of this podcast and I'm the director of camps here at Farm and Wilderness. And I'm actually recording this episode on the road. The camp directors and I and a few summer staff are about to attend the American Camp Association's New England Camp Conference. This is maybe my fifth or sixth time and it's this really great gathering in Manchester, New Hampshire of over 800 camp professionals, and we get together, and like any conference, there's some inspiring keynote speeches, there's some great sessions, and I will be leading two of the sessions. It's also a great opportunity for directors to get together, to be with some of our summer staff, and really just plan and get excited for the summer that is getting closer every day. The snow is melting, although we got a little bit of snow this past weekend, actually, but it feels warmer. The days are longer and summer is on its way. This episode is similar to last week's episode, where this is another one that is really aimed at other professionals in the education space. So if you are a former camper, family member, staff member, or anything at all, you're welcome to listen to this, especially if you are a new staff member coming in. But this is really aimed at my fellow professionals in this space. And if you are not that, again, listen in and you'll get a little bit of a peek behind the curtain of how we run Timberlake and our farm and wilderness camps. Now, you may or may not know this about me, but I used to be a teacher, a special education teacher and math teacher in New York. And I taught in Lower Manhattan and I ran a program in the Bronx and I ran a program in Brooklyn. And I've had a lot of experience working with kids, my camp and outside of camp experience. And I realized that the thing I love most is actually not teaching, but actually teaching those who teach. So this session today, this podcast is an adaptation of a session that I give at conferences and working with organizations that is all about behavior management. And I call it classroom management at camp with a question mark and an exclamation mark. So if you are a camp professional, hopefully you'll get something out of this that you can use at your camp right away. Now, I think talking about behavior can be a big, big thing. And I'll talk about that in a second. But I think what you can expect from this episode is that if you work with kids, you already come with strengths and you know how to build relationships with students, campers, and kids. And that the behavior management concepts I'm talking about are compatible with other essential concepts like relationship building, mesh, trauma-informed practices, things like that. Think of this as something you build on top of that foundation of relationship building. And lastly, if you are going to be trying these for the first time, it'll feel weird to learn new techniques and resistant is natural. You should push not to stay there though. I really equate this to like whenever you learn something new, it feels weird at first and behavior management techniques are no different. So why does talking about behavior, why can that feel so intensely personal? I think there's four reasons why when you listen to this, you might have a reaction to something I say because I'm hitting close to home. One is all things related to student or kid behavior can feel immensely personal for some folks. I just want to validate that when we were talking about behavior and kids, that can bring up some things. Because two, my second reason is that we often manage behavior and teach based on our own childhood. Now, I don't have data on this. This is like a gut thing, but I really do believe that when you get stressed, when your amygdala is fully firing because a kid is misbehaving, you will resort back to, because of that stress, whatever you yourself went to in terms of how you were managed, how your behavior was managed by family or parents, whether that was a good or bad way to manage that. Because reason three, that descriptions of and response to behavior, how we talk about kid behavior and what we do about it, are really rooted in that background, in your background and experiences, right? When stress comes, you resort to what you knew, and how you think about this is influenced by all of those years, 18 years or more, that your behavior was managed by others. And lastly, I think this is a big one. When we talk about behavior and consequences, it can really be rooted in moral judgments. This idea of bad behavior and good behavior, and you should do that and you shouldn't. There is morality involved in that. And as I go through this session, I'll touch a little bit on that, but this is really about thinking, how can you fit all of these techniques into your own feelings? And if you have reactions, know that those are probably some of the reasons. So I want to make a case for why behavior management, right? And I'm going to read a quote to you. The children now love luxury. They have bad manners, contempt for authority. They show disrespect for elders and love chatter in place of exercise. Children are now tyrants, not the servants of their households. They no longer rise when elders enter the room. They contradict their parents, chatter before a company, gobble up dainties at the table, cross their legs, and tyrannize their teachers. Who do you think said that? And when do you think they said that? So if you Google this, the internet will incorrectly, I think, attribute this to Socrates, right? And that's one of those moments of like, oh, even back then they were thinking this. And I really do believe that behavior is very much rooted in time. And there's this phrase that you will often hear, kids these days. And I actually don't think that kids these days are any different than they've always been. It's just our response and reaction to that behavior, right? That somehow we are the pinnacle, whatever generation you are, is the pinnacle of the human experience. And every kid that comes after you is somehow downhill from there. And that's just not correct, right? Families and adults have been fretting about kids these days for as long as we can remember, right? And so this is nothing new. I also think that when we think about kids these days, that the number one thing you can do for any kid to help them be successful is to have a really good relationship. That relationships are everything. And a solid relationship with a camper, a student, a kid makes prevention of and response to unwanted behaviors easier and more effective. Relationships work. However, my question and what this session, this podcast is talking about is, what do you do on day two when a kid misbehaves? You don't have a relationship yet. What are you going to do? So there are a few foundational concepts for behavior that I want to go over. The first is traditionally called MTSS, or multi-tiered student support, or simply the three tiers of intervention. I've learned this when I was a special educator, and I use it to think about behavior, and I think it's a really good way to frame it. And I want you to think of a group of kids, right? A group of campers, and every group of campers can be split into three tiers. And whatever tier they are in determines how we respond to their behaviors. Now, tier one makes up 80% of all kids in a given group. And this is understood as universal prevention or universal instruction. The idea that whatever you are doing in a classroom at a camp, it should work for 80% of the kids. This is all of your camp-wide systems, your habits. And it tends to reduce most behavior problems and increases camp fun time, right? These are the how do you enter the dining hall and what is your routine for bedtime? The things that a kid might step out of line, but they're easy to correct because the systems are there and they're like, okay, my bad, and they keep rolling. So that's 80% of kids. Tier two is the next 15% of kids above that. And this is things that don't work, maybe do work for the other 80%, but don't work for this 15%, right? They're not responding to those tier one interventions. And this is secondary interventions and supports. And these are like specialized systems for campers who need more attention, right? So maybe they don't follow the routine once. That's probably a tier one kid. But if they keep doing it, that's probably a tier two kid. And lastly, tier three is the thing that tier one and two has not worked for it, right? This is just 5% of your kids. And these are campers who need the absolute most attention, right? The one or two or three or four that are taking up feels like 90% of your staff's time. And these campers ultimately might not be a good fit for your camp. Now, what's helpful about this idea of the 80%, most kids, 15%, some kids who need a little bit of redirection, 5%, they need a lot of redirection, is that if you're finding that your behaviors are in such a way at your camp that it feels like 50% of the kids are in tier one or two, that means you have an issue with your tier ones. There's something going on with your routines and rituals that's just not clicking. My next foundational concept is three types of misbehavior. Now, I often ask in an interview, why do you think kids misbehave or do the things you call misbehavior, and often from a young educator I'll get, it's for attention. And I would argue it's not really for attention, maybe sometimes, but often behavior or misbehavior or behavior we don't want falls into these three categories. The first behavior is incompetence. And I don't mean with kind of the negative connotations. I mean really the denotation of that. The camper simply doesn't understand or know how to do what you expect of them. They just don't know, right? They don't know how to do the thing that you want them to do. The second type of misbehavior is opportunistic misbehavior, right? The camper is exploiting a gray area or lack of clarity, right? So the incompetence is they don't know how to do that. The opportunistic misbehavior is you tell a kid to stop talking and then they start whispering and they say, I wasn't talking. You said not talk and I'm whispering. They're taking advantage of that gray area. And incompetence and opportunistic misbehavior often comes because adults are not as clear as they think they are. They are often the root of the problem. The last category is defiance. The camper is trying to demonstrate that you cannot control him. And often behavior looks like it's defiance. I'd argue it's usually the other two. The last foundational concept when it comes to behavior before we go to specific techniques is the four types of consequences. So when we say the word consequence, our brain often actually thinks of punishments, right? What is the negative thing you're going to do to make sure someone doesn't do anything again? And so often in our society, right, we think of our consequences as timeout or suspension or things like that. I want you to think instead of consequences in four buckets, four types. The first one is logical. These consequences have a clear connection to the infraction or the issue at hand. So, for example, if a camper is consistently skipping out of their chores, you might give a logical consequence that, okay, camper, you skipped out of these chores. The logical consequence is that you're going to be assigned to help another cabin do their chores to make up the time that you didn't do chores. There is a connection to the infraction. The second type of consequence, and this is my favorite, this is natural consequence. These are consequences that occur without any intervention at all, right? The camper's behavior simply resulted in something, and often that thing means you might not need to apply an additional consequence. So for the example of a kid not doing the chores they're supposed to, right? A natural consequence might be, oh, they missed out on an unexpected perk that happened when they were doing the chores. Like maybe the cooks came by with an extra snack and they skipped out of chores and they missed that snack. That is a natural consequence. If they'd been there doing the work, they wouldn't have missed out on that snack. These are amazing consequences, natural. And when they happen, you are so lucky. The next one, the third one, is restorative. And this is a consequence that's focused on restoring relationships with those that are harmed. You might have heard of restorative circles or restorative justice. This is connected to that. So again, a camper is consistently skipping out of cabin chores. A restorative consequence might be that the camper is part of a facilitated discussion with the rest of the cabin to talk about the impact of those actions on them, the impact of skipping out of those chores. Restorative consequences often take more time and effort, and so you might be spending a lot of time in logical consequences or natural, but restorative often might be a part of that too. The last one is really where consequences can often be, but you don't want them to actually be. These are punitive consequences. These are consequences that have no logical connection to the actual misbehavior or behavior that you didn't want. So again, if they skipped out of their cabin chores, the punitive consequence would be that the camper doesn't get any dessert for a week, or they have to sit out of the next game. There's no connection to the actual infraction, and oftentimes, that's just going to piss the camper off. They're just going to sit there and fume and talk about how it is totally unfair, and they're not entirely wrong, right? I think that often adults go to punitive consequences because it makes us feel better at the expense of actually solving the issue for the child. So, as you're assessing the consequences in your program, try to make sure that they are logical, natural, and restorative, or natural, or logical, or restorative, but not punitive. All right, let's go to some specific behavior management techniques, right? These are things that have worked in the classroom that you can use in your camp setting. And the very, very first technique I want to talk about is the hierarchy of intervention. Six things you can do that is not yelling at a kid, right? And these are a hierarchy of interventions because we're going to start with the least invasive, the stuff that is going to be noticed by the least group of kids, the least disruptive to what you were doing, all the way to the most invasive. and that depending on the behavior, you want to start with as least invasive as an intervention and then move up this ladder if you're finding those interventions are not working. These actually come from a great book called Teach Like a Champion, which can be problematic in some ways, but I think if you think of it as another tool in your toolkit, it works just fine along all of these other kind of concepts. So there are six steps to this. The first step, right? You are with a group of kids and there's a group of kids or a smaller group or one or two, they're not doing what you need them to do. The first step in the intervention that you might do to correct the behavior is simply a nonverbal intervention, more commonly known as a teacher stare or a silent gesture. Now, if you're a teacher, you've been a teacher and educator, you have that stare, right? If you were speaking to a group of kids, sometimes you can lock eyes with that kid and that stare is enough to make them stop the behavior. And most of the kids don't notice that you're staring, right? Sometimes I'll also do silent signals to redirect, like point to my ears or point to my eyes or like point to the speaker. And that kid knows that I'm talking to them and other kids might not be picking up. That's the first step. Now, sometimes that doesn't work. I've certainly have kids where I've tried the teacher stare and they're like, what are you staring at? Ooh, my bad. Okay, that intervention's not working. Let me go to the next level. The next level of intervention is proximity, right? And so you're doing the teacher stare, it doesn't work, or maybe you can't even make eye contact. Proximity is simply you move closer to the camper while you're continuing to give instructions or do whatever you're doing. I did this in my class all the time. I had an iPad that I was able to write on and project it on the board. So sometimes when kids were cutting up in my class, I would go sit next to them and just teach from there. And I didn't have to like correct their behavior. My presence near to them knew that I saw them and that they fixed it. Now that might not work. You go up to your next step, right? You've tried your nonverbal intervention, your teacher stare, you tried moving closer. Let's try step three. This is a positive group correction. Now, positive, right? This is telling a group of kids what you want them to do. It's a quick reminder about what they should be doing and not what they shouldn't be doing, right? So this might sound something like, I really like that I see that people are starting to open their books and turn to the page. I really like that people are getting in line silently. You're assuming that the kid maybe has the incompetence, right? And doesn't know what you need from them. And you're just reminding the whole group when really you're talking to like two or three or four kids, but you're just helping the whole group remember. So maybe that doesn't work, right? You've reminded the whole group and that kid still isn't correcting, right? They're like, that's not me. They're not talking to me, right? Another way, or step four, is the anonymous individual correction, where you're explicitly naming the issue and maybe naming how many folks are not following your directions, but you still keep it anonymous, right? So you might say something like, okay, we don't have all our eyes up here yet when I need them to be, or I'm still waiting on four people to take a seat, waiting on three people to take a seat. The kids who are not doing the behavior, they will often tune into that and know that you're talking about them, and other kids may or may not pick up, right? You're still not pointing out the individual kid yet and you're not yelling. Maybe that doesn't work, right? And step five is the private individual correction. Now, this is often where young educators will go to, right? The kid's misbehaving. Oh, I'll pull them aside and talk to them. My response is usually, okay, cool. What are the other 10 kids doing? Who is with them, right? So if you, all these things aren't working, you need a private individual correction. You need to correct privately and quietly, right? You want to maintain their dignity. You don't want to make it a public performance or a war of egos, right? You do not want to correct them in front of others because you're just going to get into a match with them and there is no winning that for them or for you, right? But it has to be quietly and privately and quickly. But lastly, and if none of those worked, this is one of my favorites. This is a lightning quick public correction. I'll sometimes say drive-by that this is what this is. And this is where you are being super concise and you're keeping it rolling and you're correcting the behavior so quickly, the kid almost doesn't know what hit them. And there's kind of a confusion that comes and they're like, oh, I guess I'll fix this, right? So this might be you're the group of kids, the kid still isn't working. You go by and say, I need you to be seated and eyes on me. And then you keep walking. You don't stop. You don't let them go back and forth. You just say what you need and then keep going. And again, they're sometimes so confused that they don't know what hit them and they'll fix the behavior. Now, these six steps, the nonverbal intervention, proximity, positive group correction, anonymous individual correction, and private individual correction will work for a lot of times, but they won't always work for every kid. Please don't think that on this podcast, I'm telling you things that will work for every single kid. I'm just giving you more tools in your tool chest that you can use. So this next tool is more of a concept than a specific hierarchy of interventions kind of tool. And this is about giving clearer instructions. I would argue that most adults are not as clear as they think they are, right? The example being something like, if you want kids to be seated silent, eyes on you, because you need to give direction, and you say, all right, listen up, and some kids aren't seated silent, eyes on you, you can't get mad at them if you didn't tell them the exact thing that you wanted them to do. You were not as clear as you think you were. Let's talk about this. Let's start with tone. Tone is key. Tone is kind of everything with working with kids, especially middle schoolers and high schoolers, right? And I teach my staff that they want to aim for a balance between warm and firm. They want to be warm and firm. And this is a balance over time. Sometimes you're more warm, sometimes you're more firm. Too much of either doesn't work, right? You got to find something in between. You can't always be warm and you can't always be firm. Also, when you're using tone, you always want to maintain the dignity of the child. And this next thing, I think I'll get some disagreements on, but I will absolutely argue this point forever and ever, that sarcasm, shame, and embarrassment rarely work. Sarcasm is really not something you should try because, one, that kid might not pick up that you're being sarcastic, but also all the kids who are watching or listening, because kids are always watching and listening, might not understand that you're being sarcastic, right? Sarcasm, shame, and embarrassment, I think, make the adults feel better because it's punitive. It's not logical or restorative. Lastly, I give my counselors, when we talk about tone, this phrase, say what you mean what you say, and don't say it mean. Say what you mean what you say, and don't say it mean. I love that phrase. Now we're talking about tone. Tone setting is also key, right? And so I teach my staff that you need to start firm and warm and then loosen up over time. You can't go the other way. You can't start loose and then get firmer. You have to start with routines and rituals in place. Because in the end, at the end of the summer, because of the way our brain works and biases, kids won't really remember that you were firm in the beginning. They'll remember that they felt great at the end, right? If you start loose, they're not going to remember necessarily that you were a great counselor. They remember that they felt unsafe or loosely held. I think the best compliment a kid could give is that I like that adult, but they don't play. I like them, but they are holding me tight and I feel safe because they're holding me, because the boundaries have been given to me. Now, kids never going to ask for more boundaries. Please, sir, can I have more boundaries? That's not a thing. However, start warm and firm and loosen up, not the other way. So I believe when giving instructions, and I mean actually giving instructions, not joking around, not like just random chatter with kids, giving instructions. And depending on the activity, these instructions might be the difference between being safe and unsafe. If you're teaching how to swing an axe, they better be listening. If you're teaching them how to work with a knife or to use a kiln or to do swimming, right? All of these are activities that have risk. They need to be listening. And I think campers should follow directions quickly, correctly, and the first time. Quickly, correctly, and the first time. Now, I say this, and however, there's a big asterisk, a big but to this, and that is when you're asking campers to do that, it is because you're giving instructions, and that achieving compliance quickly, correctly, the first time is an exercise in purpose, not power. It's not about lording over them. It's about you are giving instructions ultimately to keep campers safe. You have purpose, not a pursuit of power. I have two golden rules, and then I'll give you four ways to make sure your instructions are clearer. We've talked about tone. Let's talk about these couple golden rules. Golden rule number one, never ask a question that you don't actually want the answer to. My favorite one, if you ask a kid, are you listening to me? And the kid answers, no. You can't really get mad at the kid. They answered the question that you asked, right? Don't ask a question you don't actually want an answer to. Do you like your food? No. I mean, you can get frustrated, but you did ask the question and you begged the answer, right? And so you want to work on not asking things as questions. And this is often like an upper middle class, and frankly, often white trait of like asking requests or commands as questions when actually it is a statement of fact or it is a thing that a kid should do. And this works if you're working to be warm and firm. So it's not, are you listening? It is, I need you to listen up. Warm and firm. Golden rule number 2. Don't threaten a consequence you can't follow through. If you tell a kid, "I'll make you do it," can you actually? You can't actually force a kid to do anything. You can coerce, you can cajole, you can convince, but you can't actually make them do it. I'm going to call your parents right now. Are you? Or are you going to forget? And the more you give empty threats, these consequences you're not going to follow through, the less they're going to listen over time. And they're going to know that you don't have actual power. You were just a threat, or you were just threatening. All right, these are 4 keys to giving clear instructions. We talked about tone. Don't ask a question you don't want an answer to. Don't give an empty threat. When you're giving clear instructions, right? Again, this is not the joking around, none of this. You've gotten the kids quiet and you need to tell them what to do. This is where adults can often make poor choices, poor word choices, and where kids can then kind of exploit the gray area, or they genuinely don't know what's going on and the activity doesn't work. There are 4 things that you can do. And when you're giving clear instruction, the goal is to emphasize compliance to your instructions that you can see. So you want your instructions to be specific, observable, concrete, and sequential. Specific, observable, concrete, sequential. Specific. You want whatever instruction you're giving to be solution-oriented and hard to misunderstand, right? This is, "I need you to be seated and silent and eyes on me." Rather than "pay attention." Pay attention is not specific. Go over there is not specific. "Hey, I need you to have a seat on that stump right there next to the door." That is specific. Observable. You want to give instructions on things that you can see campers do, right? If you tell a kid to pay attention, can you actually see that they're paying attention? No, you're just seeing indicators, like behaviors that they might be, right? That their eyes are on them, right? You say, "Pay attention." The kid's like, "But I was paying attention." You don't actually know if they were or not. All I can do is guess. You want to have them do things that are observable, right? Going over and sitting in a specific spot is observable. Seated silent, eyes on me is observable. Next is, it needs to be concrete. These need to be clear and actionable steps with no gray area, right? I need you to turn your body and face me so I know that you're listening. Not "listen up," right? There's no gray area. You could have a kid go back and forth about how much they turn their body, right? But you're aiming for like the specific, observable, and concrete. They know exactly the thing you're asking. And lastly, you want your instructions to be sequential, right? A clear and logical order of concrete actions, right? And I will often say these by holding up like a 1, 2, 3, 4. You've sort of heard this on the podcast. I have 4 steps I need you to do. I'll hold up 4 fingers. Step 1, say the step, hold up 1 finger. Step 2, and so on and so on. And you want to make sure you're limiting these to like 3 to 5 steps. 5 is even maybe too many, depending on the age, right? You want to make sure that you're saying do first and then second, then third and fourth. So again, if you're delivering this warmly and firmly, you're just letting a kid know what they need to do to be successful. That's all. So I want to give you 3 examples. So a camper is dancing around the activity area, not paying attention. And we are going to call this camper EJ. EJ is dancing around the activity area and he is not paying attention. There are 3 ways you can handle this. You might something like, "EJ, stop fooling around." Okay, if the misbehavior is incompetence, right? EJ doesn't know you don't want him dancing. That doesn't teach the camper, doesn't teach EJ how to solve the problem. If it's defiance, you're just calling them out, right? You're not asking them to do something differently or productive. And if it's opportunistic, telling them to stop fooling around, like, keeps that gray area going, right? What type of fooling around, right? They'll do something different instead. You might say something like, "EJ, pay attention." Again, if EJ doesn't know not to dance, that's too vague. It's not really useful. If it's defiance, right? That's an easily manipulated or ignored command, right? There's a lot of ambiguousness to it that they can use. Or if it's opportunistic, right? It's still allowing the gray area to persist. The best way is something along the lines of, "EJ, I need you to sit in that chair, be silent, and have your eyes on me." Warmly and firmly. If they're the behaviors from incompetence, you're helping them figure out what to do instead. That's solving the incompetence. If it's defiance, right, you're clearly delineating the degree you're going to allow the camper to defy you, right? "You're no longer following my directions of not being seated." That's a different thing than, "You never told me to not dance." And then lastly, if it's opportunistic, if it's that gray area misbehavior, you're removing that gray area and that ambiguity. The last technique I'm going to talk about today is the use of what's called strong voice. Now, when I talk about strong voice, I don't mean loud voice. I don't mean yelling. Strong voice is something you can actually teach someone to do. To have a strong voice, you need to square up and stand still. You need to exude quiet power. You need to use fewer words. Don't talk over, ever. Narrate the positive.
And finally, do not engage.
Now, you use strong voice when you're giving instructions. You should see a theme through all of these behavior interventions. These are tools in your tool chest. This is not when you're just hanging out with kids. You have a thing that you need to share with them. Part one, the first part of having a strong voice, is to square up and stop moving. Stop moving. Right? In that moment, the directions you are giving are the most important thing. And if you're moving around, picking up things, doing things, kids are focusing and trying to track you moving around, and they're not really listening in the same way. So if you have something you are just going to stop moving, kind of put your feet underneath you, right? Almost like the superhero Superman pose, right? They need to be about shoulder width. And like, you're just going to square up and just stop.
That is letting kids know that you have something to say and they need to listen.
The next thing is you need to exude quiet power. Now, when you get nervous or feel your control slipping away, you tend to talk louder and faster. And that lets us know that you are out of control and that you are nervous. And in fact, when you are giving instructions and you are trying to talk over, and we'll talk about this in a moment, right? But if you are getting louder to try to get the attention of the room, sometimes you need to do that. But if kids are not paying attention and you just get louder, they will often just get louder with you. Oh, the teacher's just saying something. I don't know. I'm going to keep having my conversation. And in fact, if you have some of your kids already locked in, actually, if you go quieter, it makes people lean in to listen. It is one of my favorite techniques. When you are giving instructions, once you know you have them, go a little bit quieter and they will lean in to listen to you. Stop moving. Exude quiet power. Part three, use fewer words. That's it. Be as concise as possible and watch your filler words. Your the you knows, the those sort of things. Kids only have so long of attention they're going to give you. So once you know exactly what you're going to say, say it in as few words. Part four, and this is something I see particularly young staff do this all the time. Teachers too, actually, when I coach. Do not talk over kids or campers ever. If you are giving instructions, you need to make sure that you are the one that they are focusing on and that your voice is not competing for attention, right? If you're not competing for attention, you're demonstrating to campers that their decision to listen isn't optional, isn't situational. Again, if you are talking and there's three or four kids still talking, you are letting them and all the kids know that they don't have to listen and they're just going to keep talking. And eventually you're going to lose kind of all power and respect. Do not talk over people who are talking. I interrupt my staff sometimes mid announcement making. Oh, I can't hear you. There's someone talking, to remind them that like, nah, you have the microphone. Use it. The next part of a strong voice is called narrating the positive. I love this. The last few can feel kind of intense. This one is actually a little bit different, where when you are giving instructions, right? And maybe you've already given instructions. Narrating the positive is a way of building momentum by naming the positive things you see kids that are doing correctly. So you've given instructions and you say go, and you're going to narrate the positive. You're narrating what you're seeing. I love that I see kids getting up to put their art away. I like that I see people making sure they have their name on it. I like that I see people are getting pencils and putting them in the cups. Whatever it is, you are both reminding kids what they should be doing, and you're like giving them props, right? You're giving them joy, and kids want props, right? I see you doing the right thing. Keep doing the right thing. That is a joyous, wonderful thing. Lastly, do not engage. Don't let a camper try to change the subject on you or go back and forth with you, be a broken record. When you engage, you are going to get pulled off track. I need you to go sit down, but I wasn't talking. I need you to go sit down. That's not fair. I need you to go sit down. But he was doing it too. I need you to go sit down. You're not accepting the premise of the question, often because the kid's amygdala is fully firing, right? Like, they're not probably in control of their emotions. And so you want to be as in control of your emotions, as consistent and firm as you can, because you're helping that kid both re-regulate. I'm not yelling back at you. I'm simply telling you what's expected of you. And though you're not letting the kid pull you into it. If they pull you into it, that often is going to fire your own amygdala and you might totally lose control of the situation. Now, I'm going to end it there for this episode. And a few more thoughts on classroom management, behavior management at camp. I have spent a lot of time building a camp where staff don't have to yell. And that I believe that every staff member I hire, and probably you believe this too, wants to come have those wonderful, weird, silly, thoughtful, amazing, awesome moments with kids. They want to do that. And the thing that holds them back is that those type of things take relationships, and relationships take a lot of energy. And working with kids, you get drained when kids don't listen. And kids not listening is developmentally appropriate, especially on the middle school level, the middle and high school kind of kids generally. That's just them being kids. And so when you have techniques in your back pocket, and I've given you just a few, and there are so many out there, that allows you to acknowledge that, like, your frontal lobe is not fully developed. You're making silly and frankly, sometimes stupid decisions because you're a kid, and I love you for it. And I'm here to support and help you through it. And you're not letting yourself kind of get caught up in all of that, right? Remember at the top, we talked about behavior feels so personal because there's often moralistic bent to it. Yeah, kids should listen, and sometimes they're not going to. And you need to be ready for that by having lots of tools in your tool chest and not simply trying to make yourself big and get louder and get more intense, because that very actually rarely happens. You will be better off. Now, Farm Wilderness does trainings for our staff. We are also more than willing to do trainings for your staff as well. I hope you learned a few things from this, whether you are working at camp or working somewhere else, or just get a sense of behind the scenes for this is how we manage behavior at our camps. Next week will not be another episode like this. Next week, we are going to hear from Christy Webb. She's the granddaughter of Ken and Susan Webb, who started the camps. And she is going to read excerpts from her book, Beyond Our Wildest Dreams. I am so excited to present that episode to you next Wednesday. If you'd like to register, apply for a job at, or just learn more, check out farmandwilderness.org. We're on YouTube, Instagram, and TikTok, where you will find staff testimonials. Original music by Emmett Powers, recording and editing done by myself. Thanks to everyone at Farm and Wilderness who helped make our summers possible. And the summer is coming so quickly. And with that, remember, camp magic is real, y'all. Until next time.